Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Joining me as usual, Danny LaRue. We're going to hit some news, mostly bad news, unfortunately, and then let's do a recap of an awesome night of games.
So we're starting with Marc Gasol, who had surgery on Saturday to repair a type 2 fracture of his navicular bone, and he will not return this season.
Yeah, that was pretty much expected at this point, very much foreshadowed by Memphis's moves at the trade deadline, where they kind of decided that this year was a little bit of a lost cause. The navicular bone, that's the same injury that Joel Embiid had. It's the same injury that Yao Ming had. It's a bone that's not get a lot of blood flow, kind of in the middle of the foot. Type 2 fracture means it's below the surface of the bone. He's going to have to actually have surgery to have it reset. That distinguishes it from Michael Jordan, who famously had that injury. He's also, a lot smaller than Marc Gasol. But Jordan didn't have to have surgery. All these kind of big 7-footers, it seems like they do. And while it's a small sample, it seems like just about all of these big 7-footers who have had navicular injuries have suffered from additional complications. Really bad news for Marc Gasol, really bad news for Memphis, which has a further 4 years at about $20 million a year of Gasol under contract.
And he's older than somebody like Joel Embiid, which I always get concerned about when you see a foot injury when a guy's a little bit on the older end, because we see that with ACL tears, for example, that, guys just come back from a quicker. Achilles is probably an even better example.
Yeah, and you have to wonder even if Gasol will be ready for the start of next season. Embiid, of course, missed pretty much all of his rookie year. And, part of that was just because the Sixers were in tanking mode and it didn't really matter whether he came back that year or not. They'd had success the previous year with Nerlens Noel approaching that same strategy. I imagine that Gasol will be back to start next year, but, you wonder, especially if he has a setback. And he also, when you consider his body type, a guy whose career has really waxed and waned depending on what kind of shape he was in, and considering if he just kind of isn't able to have his normal level of activity, he's obviously not going to play for Spain in the Olympics too, which is really going to be too bad. He could really end up getting kind of out of shape, and then that, of course, carrying extra weight only makes things worse when you try to come back from this type of injury. So really just devastating news for the Memphis franchise.
On the upside, I still heavily expect them to make the playoffs. They have a pretty sizable lead on the rest of the group, and they have a series of winnable games, including one that they won tonight against the Lakers. So that is, it's a nice consolation prize, and that allows them to keep their pick if they make it.
In other smaller transaction news, David Lee signed with the Mavericks. We knew that was going to happen. He signed for the room exception. The one thing that we didn't know was how much he ended up getting bought out for with the Celtics. We found that out today through our buddy Eric Pincus at Basketball Insiders. Lee only gave up a little over $400,000, and then he's going to make $2.1 million with that prorated room exception. So great business for him to actually make more money this year because he was totally unplayable in Boston.
Well done, David. Well done.
And we're not going to talk about this game too much, but he did make his debut for the Mavs today. He did not look very good. He was the first big off the bench, which I think was kind of how we expected him to be used. They also used him, though, in concert with Dirk, which is not going to be good defensively. And we'll see. Maybe Lee can really start to contribute on offense. I don't expect that he's going to be that good. I mean, usually when guys are bought out, there's a reason for that, and we'll get to another one of those guys shortly when we talk about the Warriors. What else we got for transactions?
There were two waivers that actually got players that got claimed, which is kind of cool. So the first one is that Chris Copeland got waived by the Milwaukee Bucks and to clear space for Steve Novak, and he got claimed by the Orlando Magic, which was, you could draw different ideas on it, but part of the rationale might have been that they needed to reach the salary floor, and that allowed them to do it, so they actually made money.
Yeah, they saved a little over $300,000 per the math by Bobby Marks of Yahoo, because they had to reach the salary floor. They were $650,000 short after moving on from Tobias Harris and Channing Frye at the deadline. They only still have to pay Copeland $338,000, so that's easy money for the Magic, because otherwise they just have to make up that amount to pay their players. And Copeland, maybe they'll just move on from him, or I would expect that he's going to play under 30 minutes the rest of the season for the Magic.
Yeah, I mean, I would have preferred to use that to get somebody, if you could do it, you know, on, let's say, like a one with a non-guaranteed second year, just as more of an asset play. But, you know, we're talking pretty heavy on the margins here anyway.
Yeah, you think about some of these guys who played for that Knicks team that was actually pretty good in 2012, 2013. I mean, in those 2 years, Steve Novak basically had the apogee of his career in 2012. Same thing with Jeremy Lin. Chris Copeland got that 3-year, $9 million contract from the Pacers right after that, which ended up being a horrible contract. And, you know, this is in a period where that was actually a pretty decent contract to be giving out, that 2012, 2013 offseasons. Remember, the cap wasn't growing nearly as much as it is now. So that was, those teams didn't have the money. That was actually like a pretty significant free agent investment by Indiana. And I would expect that we'll probably have seen the last of Copeland in the league now after this year.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And then the other one was John Jenkins got waived by Dallas to clear the space for the aforementioned David Lee. And he was claimed by the Phoenix Suns, presumably using the Markieff Morris trade exception because his contract was too long to fit in the minimum exception.
Right. For those who don't recall, a minimum contract exception, you can have it for up to 2 years. And Jenkins was making the minimum, but he had two more non-guaranteed years on there. So a 3-year contract, you cannot just be claimed by anyone. You have to use some sort of an exception, whether it's a 3-year exception, the mini mid-level, or the regular mid-level. And the Suns did not have that since they used cap space this year to sign Tyson Chandler. But they did have that trade exception, and so therefore they're able to claim him. Jenkins, another one of these guys who you're a little surprised, frankly, that he got claimed, because this is a team, Dallas, that desperately needed guys who could play the wing, and Jenkins still couldn't get any playing time there, and he also flunked out of Hawks University as well.
And he had a favorable contract. He has two more non-guaranteed years at the minimum, so you know, you could think about the other options they had on the table, and for Dallas to make that decision having had him the whole year speaks volumes considering their need and his contract.
Yeah, and maybe what it was is just Dallas kind of did him a favor.
Possibly.
Frankly. And they said some nice things about him being a good professional while he was there, despite the fact that he couldn't really get on the floor. So let's get to... Oh, actually, I have a little announcement first. Let's get to that. I'm actually going to be on a panel about CBA negotiations in light of increasing TV money at the Stanford GSB Sports Conference on March 2nd. So if you're a Bay Area person, you should come check that out. It's going to be a really interesting panel. Tim Connolly, the GM of the Denver Nuggets, is going to be on there. Roger Mason from the NBAPA also is going to be on that panel, as well as executive from the NFL as well. So it should be really interesting, and hopefully I'll get these guys to talk about some interesting stuff without revealing too much. This is always an interesting line to straddle in those sorts of panels, but it'll be fun, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Are you going to that, by the way?
I'm not sure yet, but I'm going to see if I can. I'm excited for you regardless. Like, I actually had kind of forgotten of the timing of it. I've gone every year that it's existed, and so I hadn't really thought about it too much, but I've enjoyed it every year, and I recommend people go.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so another signing that we saved to talk about until now was Anderson Varejão with the Warriors. They have been struggling with the backup big man positions. They haven't gotten what they had hoped to out of Mo Spates this year, who's kind of been out of shape most of the year. He's had a couple of good games, but in large part has been a pretty damaging player. Festus Ezeli is injured, thinks that he'll be back soon. And there is a reason that Anderson Varejão wasn't playing at all for the Cavs, though.
Yeah, and that's something that we've talked about it earlier. Is like when a guy gets waived, he gets waived for a reason. Especially, you know, even though Portland doesn't really have much of a need, they could have waited until after this year. And I think I'm a little bit more optimistic than you are, but he still looks, at least let's say, done adjacent, I think is probably the nice way to
done adjacent.
Yeah, I'm not willing to say it all the way yet. He's a solid screen setter. I thought he did a nice job of that tonight. And I think defensively, if he can really embrace the role of playing 10 minutes a night, I think that could be a very good thing for him. But he had some struggles tonight against a Miami front line that is not exactly formidable if you're not facing Hassan Whiteside.
I'm afraid he's soon going to be embracing the role of playing 0 minutes a night. He took Spates' minutes in this game, really played most of his minutes actually with Steph Curry, which Kerr will like to do with some of the deeper bench guys to kind of get them indoctrinated in the game and not kill the team when they're out there. but he just looked so slow on pick and roll defense, just has no explosion. I mean, he was really a guy that even before the Achilles injury was really slowing down. And since he's been back, you know, is not really in the greatest shape from a body composition standpoint. And he had probably 5 or 6 chances to score where he was set up really nicely by Steffi, missed a jumper, missed the layup, and then passed up like 3 more shots. And it was, you know, some of that was kind of overpassing. Some of that he'll find a little bit better of a fit. But I think most discouraging was just that he looked completely out of his element defensively, and Hassan Whiteside absolutely destroyed him in the second part of the first quarter in this game.
I also want to note that I was absolutely delighted by Varejao trying a giant killer in this game, and I was trying to think of the tallest player I've ever seen try one of those. And
probably Bogut.
Yeah, Bogut. I was wondering if like Sean Bradley ever did one, because it's just amusing to me to see like a 6'10" guy do one of those shots.
Did Sean Bradley ever dribble though? That's my question.
That's a good.
I feel like it's kind of got to be off the dribble.
Why couldn't we have had Sport View then? I mean, we could have answered this question.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the game in general. I thought in the first half, it really took on the tenor of many games. I shouldn't say many because they haven't lost that many, but most of the games that Golden State has lost where they're just kind of getting out hustled. Steph Curry was playing really well to keep him in it, but they're really just relying on him and the offense. And then the other team was hitting some ridiculous shots. Josh Richardson probably had the best game of his career, shooting really well from 3. I think he had 15 points. Wade was hitting everything from mid-range, which he predictably cooled off eventually, but he had just an unbelievable first half as well. And I thought the key stretch of the game was when the Warriors were able to close it down to a 4-point deficit right before half after trailing by about 10 or more for most of that first half.
Yeah, that was a big stretch. And also, I thought they did a respectable job in the beginning of the fourth quarter. Like, I always kind of feel like that's a time that the wheels can come off, especially if it's a close game and depending on how the other team sees it. And I don't remember what the exact margin was, but I remember that I felt like when they brought Curry back in, it's like, okay, this is definitely gettable from here.
Yeah, the Warrior bench really struggled in that first half, especially down the end of the first quarter when Miami basically got out to, I think, a 13-point lead. They're up like 30-17 at one point. As I recall, Amari Stoudemire amusingly played the first 6 minutes of the game and never appeared again, going 0-for-2.
The Bogans.
During that period. Whiteside came in. He had 21 points on only 13 shooting possessions, which was pretty impressive, and 13 rebounds, though they did keep him off of the offensive glass pretty well. He played 31 minutes, started the second half somewhat predictably, and then the only other big really who played other than Whiteside was Josh McRoberts. He really played at center much of the time.
And he did a really nice job on Varejao. I think it was his quickness and his aggressiveness that Varejao just couldn't really handle.
Yeah, he got some alley-oops early on, and you saw the difference in that second quarter when they came back with Bogut. Bogut just has a little bit more strength, just a little bit more craft even in guarding the pick and roll than Varejao. It certainly seemed like, at least in this first game. So he was able to kind of disrupt some of those alley-oops. I mean, that's really Whiteside got most of his points during that 6-minute stretch or so when Varejao was in. Another thing we should talk about is that the Heat's only other point guard on their roster outside of Goran Dragic, Beno Udrih, is now out for the year, essentially. He has a torn plantar plate in his right foot, and so the Heat now can't sign anybody else. They only have 39 days, basically, of minimum contracts that they can sign guys to without going into the tax, which they absolutely are not going to do. So they've got to basically just ride out these next couple of weeks before they try and sign a point guard, because they really need another one. Josh Richardson is the only other guy who really even can pretend to be a point guard on this team right now.
Yeah, so to me, they're going to have to stagger Wade and Dragic more, just because he's another guy who can run parts of the offense. And they can do that. And actually, you can put it.
And that'll be good for them.
Yeah, that'll be good for them. And also, I think they should let McRoberts. I mean, you don't probably want him to be the only playmaker on the floor, but you give him a little bit more rope. I've always thought he can do some interesting things in that situation. But I feel like where we have to go after this is Hassan Whiteside's, let's call it, unique choice of pick and roll defense against the Warriors.
Yeah, well, we should also just mention that going into this, there was a Twitter feud between Green and Whiteside over the summer, which Hassan related in lurid detail into the press leading up to it. I'm sure he was asked about it. You know, I don't think he was intentionally going there. And then Draymond Green basically did the old, oh, I don't even remember that happened routine. But that was a Whiteside basically was saying that he would kill small lineups. We didn't really get to see him play against a small lineup that much. But Whiteside, I think if they had gone there, and that's something else we'll get to with since they didn't really deploy the green at center lineup at all against him, but he just will not leave the paint at all on defense. He did it once, maybe the entire game, when he blocked Draymond Green's jump shot from three down at the very end. But the Warriors were just getting wide open anytime the guy guarding Whiteside set a screen for Curry or for Thompson.
Yeah, you mentioned early in the game that Thompson was basically getting 15-footers whenever he wanted him. Curry was getting threes. They were pushed out a little bit, but that doesn't really matter for him. And the Warriors are going to take advantage of that. They're a team that if that's the decision you're going to make, they can do a lot with it. And sometimes those 15-20-footers aren't going to go in. Sometimes they are. But that's a pretty solid shot for the guys that they're going to have taking it. And one of the things that I will give Whiteside a lot of credit for in this game is I thought he did a nice job running the floor offensively, and I think that was what helped open things up in the second quarter.
Yeah, that's true. They did get some in transition late first, early second. But especially if they ever got into a playoff series with the Warriors, which they never will because the Heat aren't going to make the finals. But Bogut is a good enough screener that he's going to obliterate that guy who's guarding Curry or guarding Thompson. And if your big isn't going to step up, I mean, I thought that the Heat, despite giving up a buck 18, actually dodged quite a few bullets in this game, as Thompson, up until the fourth quarter, was just missing wide open 17-footers coming off of pin downs from Bogut. And the Warriors barely ran the Curry guy guarded by Whiteside pick and roll until the very end. And then as soon as they ran it down at the very end of the game, Curry just got two pretty open threes and iced the game.
Yeah, and it was, I don't really know how to feel about it, whether it was just an anomaly, but the Warriors in general just had a lot of trouble defending Wade. Yeah, he made more shots than he usually does. You know, he was taking them, but I feel like he is the type of guy that can bedevil Klay Thompson a little bit. He's so crafty and he's so good at drawing fouls, and Klay, of course, can give way to that at moments in time.
Well, it's funny, actually. Wade was even able to score on Andre Iguodala in the first half. He was able to blow by him. He hit a couple of jumpers over him. When it was Harrison Barnes who would get switched onto him, or even Draymond Green, he was able to be effective. And then he really didn't do much in the second half other than just kind of draw his BS fouls. But it was still a fantastic game. Heat season high for any player. 32 points, although Wade also notably was negative 13, which is by far the worst on the Heat of anybody.
Yeah, that is important to note. Is now the time to start talking about why start complaining that the Warriors didn't play the death lineup?
Yeah, it is. This was not one of my favorite efforts from Kerr, but Ethan actually was kind enough to send me the audio after he asked Kerr why they didn't go with that, and here's what Kerr had to say.
You used Draymond at center only for brief stretches when Whiteside was on the floor. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, Whiteside is he's a handful, obviously. And, you know, they didn't start him, which we expected. And so, you know, the first 6 minutes we were in our regular rotation. And once he came in, we started in on our next rotation. So it didn't match up well. So at the beginning of the second half, we were all set to start B. Rush, and then they started Whiteside, so I pulled B. Rush back. But the matchups just dictated the way we subbed in tonight. That's why I didn't get Mo in. You know, it was either Whiteside or it was Small. There was nothing in between. And so we went with Bogut and Anderson. And if not, you know, then we stayed Small with B. Rush.
So basically it sounds like that's what it was. They just didn't want to go with that small lineup against Whiteside. My position would be, whatever you think Whiteside is going to do, he's not going to post you up. And the Heat were playing small around Whiteside, so it's not like if they just box out Whiteside, they can still get a defensive rebound just fine. Whiteside only had two offensive rebounds in this game, which is not that much for a center in 31 minutes. And there's no way, I don't think, that Whiteside has either the discipline or the foot speed to get out and guard that lineup either. I mean, to me, that lineup is one of the best lineups, if not the best lineup in NBA history so far. And there's absolutely no reason not to play that and make the other team prove that they can stop you. You know, I think that that is sort of the much more likely prior prediction, that the other team's not going to be able to stop you and you're going to be able to defend them, than versus, oh, they're taller than us, like it's not going to work.
It surprises me for a couple reasons. One of them is the competitive advantage thing you just said. And you think about, oh, they're going to post up with Hassan Whiteside. You mean the guy who has had 15 assists in a season, I believe, once in his career? Like, that's going to be the guy, so you're not going to be able to figure out a way to force him to cause problems. And he's already...
Yeah, that's a great point. You can just double him, yeah. Right? Like, that's what everyone forgets about playing against that lineup, is they're so fast that even if they get in a mismatch in the post, you can just double, and there's really no other lineup in the NBA that's going to recover back more.
And you can double from the weak side. You can do lots of things. He's not going to make that pass, so you can figure out and get back. And then the other part of it is what you talked about with defending in space, which is the idea that the advantage that you create is almost always bigger than the advantage that you create for them. And that is what concerns me about that, is that's kind of the logic of there is similar to what Luke Walton used at a couple moments. And I thought, oh, you know, Luke's young, he's a little bit conservative in that way, and you know, that can happen. That's not a super big criticism of Luke, it's just he was more conservative with the death lineup, the nuclear lineup, whatever. Hearing Kerr say that is a little bit concerning, because there are teams in the West that have legit big men, and at this point it's pretty well established how good those lineups are. So I hope that changes, and there's plenty of time for it too. I mean, it already happened in the finals where they did it against a team that went big. But in a situation like this, where I think it could have solidified the game much earlier, it would have been great to deploy it.
Yeah, it's the regular season. I get that. Also, Draymond Green looked a little bit slow defensively for most of the game, with an off night in Miami beforehand. Maybe not entirely surprising. So maybe that's another reason they didn't want to go to that.
And a game tomorrow.
Yeah, and they have a game tomorrow. But I do think that Kerr is a little bit more old school, really, than he necessarily should be. He still always wants to kind of do things the traditional way, the way he kind of thinks things should work. And this, he's not unique among that. It's pretty much just about every coach other than, like, Don Nelson probably kind of is that way. And then, you know, maybe if they get down in a series or they're down in a game, then all of a sudden he'll go to, like, the real lineup. But if you really think that that's the best lineup, if that's what you're going to go to when you're desperate, why wait until you're desperate? Why not just go for it right now? I guess we're getting a little far afield here, but I did think that was interesting, and as you said, something to watch. But ultimately, the Warriors just got bailed out from a subpar effort by Steph Curry and to a lesser extent, Klay Thompson.
Yeah, they were both incredible. Klay's fourth quarter was notable. It was also amazing. You don't see this from an MVP who's the scorer that Steph is, but there was a moment in the fourth where he could tell Klay was heating up, and he basically just forced Klay to shoot a three-pointer. He basically moved everybody out of the way and just did that, and you don't see that very often from somebody in his position. And I thought, and he made it, thankfully for Steph, but that was a moment that really resonated for me with this team.
Yeah, although I think that when they struggled, number one, it was because they didn't go to Green at center down the end. Then they were trying to find Klay a little bit too much. And, you know, all right, Klay was doing well. You want to feed him, but it's Steph Curry. It's a guy having maybe the greatest season ever. You got to put the ball in his hands at the end. And, of course, he finally delivered with two really long threes out of those pick and rolls where Whiteside really wasn't able to step up. And to give you an example, this is our sort of amazing Warriors stat of the game, or stat of the day, which there's no shortage of these. The Warriors are 17-1 in close games this year, games that were within 5 points with 5 minutes to go. Steph Curry, in those situations, 43% usage rate, 59% e-field goal percentage, 69.2% true shooting in those situations. And the Warriors have a 42.7 net rating in close games when Curry is on the floor.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah, just more fodder for the having the best season ever. And yeah, you know what? This is turning into another edition of the Warriors World Podcast, but I don't care. This team is just that good. We're never going to have a chance to talk about a team this good ever again. I love talking about them. I love watching them. And, you know, sorry, I realize this is a national podcast, but you're going to get a lot of Warriors talk on here. It's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, and when that dynamic changes, we'll change with it.
Couple other just small notes in this game. Justice Winslow did very little offensively, and I still think that he's going to be a massive offensive liability in the playoffs. The Heat, just in general, took very, very few three-pointers. They were really lucky to go 6 of 14 just because Josh Richardson, who was shooting in the 20s this year from three, went 3 for 3. Wade doesn't shoot threes. Dragic was 1 out of 5. Luol Deng, not a good three-point shooter. Winslow didn't even shoot any at all. But Winslow was fantastic. Got on the offensive glass for 4 offensive rebounds. He had a couple of awesome blocks in transition. And then he actually, once he switched on to Klay Thompson in the fourth, he actually doused him on a couple of those late possessions. So he really is looking like he's going to be a fantastic offensive player, energy guy. The question is just going to be, can he really get to be a good enough shooter to where he's going to be an awesome role player and even could become a pretty good scorer, because he has the athleticism and he has the feel and he plays harder than, you know, just about any 19-year-old rookie that I can ever remember.
I really like him. It's a little bit unfortunate that he's in this class where so many guys are just awesome, because he would be getting more attention. But, you know, assuming Miami makes the playoffs, he can get that then. One thing that I noticed in this game, I noticed it and then I looked up the stat with it, was that while the assist totals were pretty even, the Warriors had 13 secondary assists and 4 free throw assists. Miami had 2 and 2. And so that kind of gives you an idea of how they score differently and how their ball movement is different.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the Warriors actually having 23 assists, that's kind of low for them when they score a buck 18. But I think a lot of those potential assists just ended up being missed. For the Heat, Josh McRoberts, we kind of talked about how he's coming back and he has some advantages as a guy who can pass, has good feel, is sort of just a good kind of glue guy. But the Warriors did force him to shoot, and he was just really unable to take advantage. They were giving him the shot a lot of the times, and he went 2 for 8, really did not look very comfortable trying to score. Maybe as he continues to get back into things, he'll look a little bit better there. But I do suspect that he's another one of these guys like Winslow, where you could just is kind of a non-threat offensively, and another guy who, you know, you can kind of get by with those guys in the regular season where, you know, everyone's just sort of playing their standard defense. But once teams can realize in a playoff series that you can just help off McRoberts, you can help off a Winslow anytime, that this team just can't hit three-pointers, I think they are going to really, really struggle in the playoffs offensively, even if by some miracle Bosch is able to return this year.
It's amazing how many teams in the Eastern Conference I have that same concern on, the, oh, when they get into a 7-game series, they're going to get exploited. Basically, it's everybody but the top two. And even Toronto, you know, I like Toronto, but I think that they're only a cut above because they don't have the four teams in the West that exist.
All right, let's go to the other game that I spent a ton of time on. This was Cleveland and Charlotte. The big problem for Charlotte in this game was that their transition D, normally just ironclad under Steve Clifford, that's really the biggest thing that he did to improve their defense from being one of the worst in the league when he took over. Their transition D was awful in this game. They'd given up 23 fast break points by a couple minutes left in the third, and that by that point the game was really over. Kyrie was getting out in transition. LeBron was getting out in transition. It was tons of layups at the rim. J.R. Smith was able to bomb some threes, a couple of them really tough looks, but other ones pretty open when the defense got sucked in transition. So very disappointing from Charlotte. I'm sure that Steve Clifford will be spending plenty of time on that in film session going forward.
Do you think that was more Cleveland being good on transition offense, which of course they are, Charlotte just having an off night? Because, I mean, Charlotte had rest. This wasn't an issue where they had a back-to-back on either end. The last game they played was on Sunday. Their next game is on Friday.
Yeah, I think they just didn't get back. Part of it, I think, too, is that they played Al Jefferson quite a bit. And also just that they generally don't have anybody on this team who can protect the rim. So in some cases, even when their bigs were back, I've always felt like getting your big man back is the key to transition defense against great transition finishers like LeBron and Kyrie, because if you just have their man there when they have a head of steam, that's not going to be enough. You got to have a rim protector behind them. But a lot of times that's not even when the guy's there, he's not going to be able to block a shot. Charlotte doesn't really have anyone like that on their roster. But even then, a lot of times too, Al Jefferson in particular wasn't getting back. He's coming off the bench now, scored reasonably well in this game. He was 5 out of 9, had 12 points, and he was also negative 25.
Yep.
And a well-earned negative 25. I mean, he's just provided very little resistance on the pick and roll. You know, guys would get downhill on him. He really would just, you know, it was LeBron Euro stepping around him. It was Kyrie Irving Euro stepping around him. It was Richard Jefferson Euro stepping around him. And then when he would really exert himself, he decided the time to really step out hard was on Matthew Dellavedova, who, of course, can't make a 2-point shot, and was just finding guys like Mozgov and Tristan Thompson. So it was really a bad performance from Al Jefferson. And one thing I think we're going to need to watch very closely going forward is Al going to play more, or is Cody Zeller going to play more at center? Because I think Zeller, while he doesn't do as well individually statistically in the box score, this guy's always been a pretty good plus-minus guy, and I think he's just a much, much better defensive player. And this team now, unlike in past years, has plenty of firepower on the perimeter. They don't need Al scoring nearly as much as they did.
And the last point you made is, I think, the most salient here, which is that the advantages that you get from Al Jefferson, you know, he's back to the basket game, he doesn't turn the ball over, he can, you know, he can be a key piece of your offense. Not only have those advantages, I think, dissipated a little bit, and you could say that'll come back when he, you know, he's all the way back from his injuries and things like that, but it's also a less valuable advantage for them now than it used to be. And the defensive stuff, especially as the game has evolved a little bit, is going to be harder to maintain, and the weaknesses that he has on that end aren't really going to get better.
We talked in the 15 and 60 about how good Charlotte's bench has been with guys like Jeremy Lin and Jeremy Lamb. Those two guys were both really bad in this game. Lamb was a negative 16 in only 9 minutes, had one free throw to his name, and that was about it. Lin was getting lit up by J.R. Smith, who had 16 points on 12 shooting possessions, but was great in the first half. And Iman Shumpert is still out with having re-aggravated his shoulder, so Smith actually played 34 minutes in this game. And Lin actually had to be taken out because Smith was just shooting right over the top of him. Didn't play too well. Frank Kaminsky had another good game against the Cavs, which was encouraging. Hit some threes. He was 3 out of 6 on threes. But a big difference for Cleveland was Channing Frye, even though he was playing at the four.
Yeah, there we talked on Monday's podcast about how it was going to have to be an adjustment for Cleveland to really know what to do with it, and it seemed like they got a lot better just in those 2 days. And learning where he was going to be, he wasn't picking and popping every time. He had one where he scored on a roll. I think he got a roll and then a layup. And you can get...
That's true. He did have 9 shot attempts, and only 8 of them were 3 points.
Yeah, and I remember the one. but there is...
Yeah, that was a nice play. I remember that one.
But there is something to be said for having that somebody who can create that kind of reliable offense, even on a team that can be pretty strong offensively.
Yeah, and Frye, especially when you consider kind of what they're trying to do, maybe in some circumstances he actually helps more on offense than Kevin Love does, because he is... a higher release, a quicker release, a more versatile release from three than Love does. And he actually has looked semi-okay trying to kind of hard hedge, because Cleveland, they usually have their big stay back on the pick and roll if it's the five, and then at the four, they're hedging out more. And Frye didn't look terrible in that. Not that Charlotte has the most dynamic of ball handlers to attack him, but he's a more reliable shooter than Kevin Love is at this point. Love seems like he's going to shoot 37%, whether he's, you know, taking contested shots, you know, sort of off screens, creating something, or whether he is just wide open. He's just not quite that absolute dead bang knockout guy. And Frye kind of is that guy.
He is. And also, if what you're looking for is more of a low usage jump shooting big, Frye has been doing that for years. Like, that's something he has, you could call it muscle memory on that. Like, he knows how to do it. He knows where to be. And if, particularly for me, in some ways, if you're playing him with both LeBron and Kyrie, who are, of course, both excellent pick and roll guys, you're not going to have as many touches for Love. So maybe in those circumstances, you tilt a little bit more that way. We both talked about how we think he fits better as a center. But yeah, there are moments where you do that. And that is not to denigrate Kevin Love or to say he doesn't have a place on this team. But in certain circumstances, there is a value that Frye can provide that Love just doesn't really do.
Couple more notes here. It was a 114-103 victory for the Cavs. By the way, I suppose it's always helpful to actually say what the score was, but they were up by 20 midway through the fourth, and the Hornets kind of came back a little bit in garbage time. It was definitely, you know, Aaron Harrison and Jorge Gutierrez both played 4 minutes in this game, so that'll tell you that it was definitely garbage time. But a few notes. One thing to watch when you watch Charlotte play, late clock, a lot of times they will have a big, either usually their foreman, either Marvin Williams or Kaminsky, come to set a pick and roll, but because there's so little time left on the clock, they will just do an automatic slip of that, and there's an unbelievable pass by Nick Batum through Tristan Thompson's legs to Marvin Williams for a layup on that play. But that's something the Hornets love to do a lot in the late clock. So kind of if you're scouting them or if you're just watching them play, that's something that they'll do, and it's really effective for either Marvin Williams or Kaminsky. I thought that Charlotte really hurt themselves by not going under on LeBron pick and rolls. LeBron did shoot 2 out of 4 on threes in this game, but off the dribble, he really, in the aggregate, has not been that good ever since he got to Cleveland. So they still were trying to go over the top of those screens, really getting picked off, and then LeBron was able to get downhill against their bigs. It's especially important to go under against LeBron when if LeBron gets one-on-one against your big like Zeller or, God forbid, Al Jefferson, he's just going to be able to score on him anyway. And LeBron was very efficient, 8 out of 13, 5 of 8 from the free throw line in this game. And Kyrie, you know, you can't go under on him, but he also had a fantastic game with 23 points.
You watched this closer than I did. There's a distinct possibility this is a first-round series, or depending on how things worked, even maybe a second-round series. Did you feel like you gained any knowledge from this that you think would be pertinent for that?
Well, Charlotte did kind of take it to Cleveland at home. I actually, not necessarily from this game, but I think Charlotte could take a game or two at home off of Cleveland. I don't think they're going to win any games in Cleveland, but I think they actually have a pretty good home court, and Charlotte has been one of the better home court teams compared to how they've been on the road. And then one last note I had too, actually two last notes. Mozgov still just is so much less explosive this year after that knee injury compared to last year. I mean, even when he was able to get up for a dunk, he was just barely kind of snaking it over the rim. And then I have noticed that Cleveland has run more stuff for Love. They've been setting him some down screens. They had one play where Kyrie Irving set a down screen for him to pop out for a jumper. That's kind of more of the stuff that they did for him in Minnesota, and the type of stuff that I've been asking, pleading for them to do for him. But I still think that the straight post-ups for him are not that good, especially because when he's playing with LeBron, LeBron isn't that great of a shooter, and they actually were able to help again off of LeBron on some of those Love post-ups, like their previous opponent, whose name escapes me, was able to do as well.
I can't remember it either. Do you want to talk about Denver Clippers?
Oh, no, it was Detroit.
That's who it was. Yeah.
Monday, yeah, I do want to talk about Denver Clippers. You saw a little bit more of this one than I did. I thought the key was that the Clippers only scored 39 points in the first half, and actually they really only scored 82 or whatever it was for the whole game. How did Denver stop them so well?
I didn't see anything that was particularly like from a scheme perspective. Some of it is that it looked like Chris Paul had an ankle issue that was lingering, and they of course don't have a backup point guard right, but they have Prigioni, but Prigioni was in foul trouble as well. What was shocking to me about so I mostly saw the fourth quarter was that, you know, the Nuggets did hemorrhage the legal lead a little bit, but Jokic and Fareed barely played, if they played at all, in the fourth quarter. And Jokic actually did some nice things in the third, which I saw as well. And that was surprising to me. They were playing Joffrey Laverne for stretches. They were, you know, of course, Gallinari was out there. And I'm kind of sitting there going, it's kind of the John Lovitz is Dukakis. Like, how are they losing to these guys? And that isn't to denigrate Denver. They played a good game. But it was just like the specific groups that they had out there seemed exploitable by the Clippers. And some of it was missed shots. The Clippers actually attempted, I believe it was the most three-pointers of any team this season so far. I think they ended at 36 attempted threes. So, you know.
No, 45. For the whole game.
Oh, good Lord.
Franchise record, 45 three-point attempts. They made only 13 of them, so that's 29%.
Yeah. So that's a big part of it.
They also just were not good on their defensive glass, especially when Fareed was in. He played 22 minutes, had 21 points, and 6 offensive rebounds during that time to the tune of +7. This is a team, this is really kind of one of the few times that we've seen big really hurt small, because they started with Mbah Mute and Paul Pierce, and those two guys are not going to be stopping Kenneth Fareed, especially because they're putting Mbah Mute on Gallo to try and stop him. Paul Pierce trying to box out Kenneth Fareed at this point in his career did not work at all. Fareed, interestingly, did not close the game, though. I think Malone went with defense, and his closing lineup was Moutier, Harris, Will Barton, Gallo, and then Jokic, and that lineup is not really a good defensive lineup, but it held up well enough, especially because they couldn't really score down the end of the fourth. But really, Denver was up by 10 or so for much of this game, and the Clips managed to get back within about 5 or 3 or so, but couldn't get over the hump because they kept missing three-pointers despite a slight flurry at the beginning of the fourth
quarter. And there was a big stretch by Gary Harris where I believe he had a steal, and then he had a three-pointer. I think it might have been the same possession, it might have been the next one, and it was at a point when Denver really wasn't doing a whole lot right. And
yeah, that was the shot of the game where they had like 5 seconds left on the shot clock. They're inbounding from the baseline, had to throw it way out to Harris at the three-point line, and he faked, got Jamal Crawford in the air, and hit like a 26-foot three-pointer when the Clippers had gotten within 5 to put him up 8, and that was kind of the key shot as there are about 3 minutes left in the game at that point.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention, it's always weird to me when guys do this, and so for stretches of the third quarter and fourth quarter, Gallinari would get a mismatch on him, and he would just settle for a shot, and then sometimes he would press it, which is great, but...
You're talking about a mismatch on Chris Paul?
Yeah, Chris Paul, or even just, or they had DeAndre on him once, and he's just kind of like, meh.
Yeah.
And then he had a tip dunk. Like he still has not his peak athleticism, but he's still up there, and he still uses it sometimes. And that's always what kind of gets a little bit frustrating for me is when a guy has it and doesn't use it as regularly, but he still had a good game.
Yeah, and he's not a great finisher at the rim. He'll get to the free throw line a lot. And his mid-ranger, with his height, he's one of the few guys I actually feel kind of okay about him, quote-unquote, settling in those situations when he is going to be wide open. I think he actually, kind of one-on-one, you almost would rather have a bigger guy on him and force him to put the ball on the floor. Will Barton has come back to earth a little bit. He was only 1 out of 6, and only played 13 minutes, actually, in this game, and he had 5 turnovers during that period. So a pretty rough game for him, although he did close the game out.
Yeah, he forced some rough passes to Joffrey Laverne at, I think it was in the middle of the fourth quarter, where their offense was stagnating a little bit, and the passes were never there, and he just kept on trying to do it, which is admirable in a weird way. And one other thing I wanted to mention, just because I think this will be something you and I watch just on the abstract for the rest of the year, is that Denver is now a half game behind the Knicks. And as some listeners will know, Denver has a swap right with that, and I think we're both a little bit higher on what Denver could do the rest of the season. And if they move clear of the Knicks, then that starts to get a little bit more interesting in terms of how they think about the rest of the season.
Jeff Green had some wonderful moments in the fourth quarter for the Clippers, and he also finished 3 out of 10 and 0 for 3 on threes. He was playing the four. He had a couple of nice blocks. You know, I joked on Twitter during the game that block was going to cement his reputation as a good defender for 2 more years, even though there's really no statistical evidence that that's actually true. And it was sort of the Jeff Green experience, a few impressive plays and overall not really doing all that much to help his team win. And really just some miserable three-point shooting by everyone other than Chris Paul and J.J. Redick in this game. Redick deserves mention for being 6 out of 12 on threes and scoring 20 points. He's just continues what's been a fabulous season.
He's been such a huge part of their success. I mean, people think about it as a big three, but he is not as integral as those guys, but pretty close.
And another guy had a really weird game was Moutier. Played 30 minutes, 1 out of 12 from the field. Did hit 2 big free throws down the end, which was good to see since he struggles from the line. But he did have 6 assists and 0 turnovers, which is always good to see from him. And he probably should have had way more than 6 assists because he threw some wonderful passes to his bigs in this game that they ended up flubbing. So Moutier looked really good at times, but still you look and he's 1 for 12. That's always concerning. And Gary Harris, of course, had another real good game as well. I think he is someone who's coming along pretty nicely and is looking like he could be a fixture as a shooting guard in Denver for quite some time.
And I like Harris because he's somebody who can fit in. You know, if he needs to be the third guard, that's totally fine. I mean, you don't want him running the offense, but you can have him in a smaller role, and I think he'll do fine. And with Moutier, you have to look for specific things when you're dealing with somebody as young as he is who has the assignment he does. And one thing that was encouraging is that he could get to a lot of different spaces on the floor against a very good defensive point guard, even though Chris has a couple limitations right now just because of injuries. And the problem is, at some point in his career, he's going to have to actually make some of the shots that he can create for himself, because otherwise you're limited in the value you can do. But I still love his court vision, and I think that he has the right kind of mentality with that. And when I watch the Nuggets, I keep on thinking about that, you know, if they can get another piece or two and then just another 2 to 3 years, I really like what they have as kind of a foundation, and that they should have the materials to get better as well.
All right, some quicker hitters now. Let's get to Chicago and Washington.
Oh.
The Bulls were missing Derrick Rose, and even before then, you would have thought that Washington would be a favorite in this game, though they have had a pretty rough schedule coming out of the All-Star break. I think this is already their fourth game since the All-Star break, since they had that 3 in a row. They're playing in Chicago. Rose missed the game with precautionary, quote-unquote, with hamstring tendonitis. Still, it seems like he misses games all the time, but he is on pace to play about 70, which I think would be considered a victory if he can actually make it there. But the Wizards entered play, I think they were 26 and 29, and the Bulls were 29 and 26. the Bulls are kind of projected right now, especially with Butler being out, Mirotić being out still, as maybe their competition for the eighth seed. And to go now four games behind the Bulls after losing 109-104 in a game that wasn't that close is pretty miserable for Washington.
It is. I felt like at moments that it's like, oh, is it time to write them off? I will mention, though, that it was their fifth game since the break. So it was their fifth fifth game in 7 days, which is something that you don't see very often anymore.
That's true. On the other hand, the Bulls started Etuan Moore, Tony Snell, Mike Dunleavy, Taj Gibson, and Pau Gasol.
Oh, good God.
Gasol actually only took 5 shot attempts in this game, but he did have 14 defensive rebounds and 9 assists. So the plan kind of was for the Bulls to run the offense through the elbows. Taj Gibson actually had a career-high 7 assists, which you were kind enough to look up. I was shocked at that. So good to see that Taj is passing the ball a little bit since he's well-known as one of the league's bigger black holes. But as long as he's not actively posting up, he's not a selfish guy. You know, he'll look for guys, but once he kind of goes into his move posting up, he turns into a black hole. But I was shocked that he managed to have that many assists. Gasol had 9 assists, as I said. And then Etuan Moore only had 1 assist, but he managed 17 points and was kind of the closer for the Bulls, hit 2 or 3 really tough shots in this game.
And you seem pretty positive on Mike Dunleavy. Was that more of a physical thing, or was it more his actual play?
No, he played great. He had 14 points on 9 shooting possessions, 2 of 4, and he's just a smart player. You know, one play that really exemplifies kind of how good he is, he's guarding Garrett Temple in the corner. Usually you wouldn't want to give up a corner three. You wouldn't want to rotate off the corner when there's no one to go in behind you. But the Wizards ran a flare screen for Bradley Beal, who's obviously a very good three-point shooter. He would have been wide open. And so Dunleavy came up off the corner, said, all right, throw it to Garrett Temple in the corner. We'll let him shoot it. And he shot it and missed it. And it was just the right play. It was a smart play, the kind of thing that has enabled him to be a positive impact on defense, despite the fact that he can't stop anybody, you know, just in an ISO one-on-one.
Because I have to mention it, since you led into it so well, earlier, or around actually, it was maybe a little bit later in the night, Lance Stephenson had the choice between guarding Kobe Bryant or guarding D'Angelo Russell, and he chose Kobe and gave D'Angelo Russell an open three, and it's like exactly the same situation and choosing the reverse.
Yeah, the Wizards started Jared Dudley at the four. He did not play very well. Taj Gibson really attacked him in the post. Another instance, really, where the small lineup got beaten by the big lineup, because and when you don't have a particularly dynamic player, you know, with like Paul Pierce and Bob Mute and Jared Dudley, Otto Porter also was miserable in this game. He only played 17 minutes and had 2 points. Then, yeah, you know, if the big players are just way better than the small players, going big actually kind of works a little bit better. And two other guys who had really good games, other than Moore, who kind of closed, and John Wall, he actually kind of lit up John Wall a little bit. Wall did not have one of his best games. Doug McDermott had another really good game for the Bulls. They actually finally got him into the post when he was being guarded by Rowan Sessions, and he hit this really sweet Dirk fadeaway from 18 feet. I still think that he can be pretty effective in that role, especially because if he's playing alongside Jimmy Butler, whoever the bigger, stronger wing defender is always going to be guarding Butler. And so I think that McDermott, you know, not as the foundation of the offense, but 2, 3, 4 times a game should get some post touches, and he's also, you know, a good passer, and he's not going to just hold the ball down there forever either. You know, he can kind of duck in. He did that a lot when he was in college. And then Tony Snell was 4 of 5 on threes. This is one of those games where he was hitting his three-pointers, and he was plus 13 on the night, played a really nice game as well.
And the Bulls are going to need contributions from basically everybody to stay afloat, especially with the Pistons possibly playing better moving forward, because I personally feel like that's their biggest competition for the eight.
Bulls backup bigs, not so great. Bobby Portis was negative 12. Cristiano Felicio was negative 17. Portis was 2 for 8. Aaron Brooks managed to get up 15 shots in 20 minutes, which is 0 of 5 on threes, which was not a surprise. And Markieff Morris, although he did have 10 rebounds, really continues to struggle. He played 28 minutes and was 1 out of 7. He is not really finding yet his niche in this Wizards offense. He's had a lot of games that have sort of been like that so far since coming over.
If you were in charge of the Wizards at whatever capacity you want to value, when would you start seriously thinking about the protection on your pick and going in that direction?
Before I made the trade. uh, Yeah, I don't know. I think once you – most teams – the Wizards actually have a little bit more of an analytics department than I think a lot of teams do. I think once you're getting down to 10% or so – but this team has enough talent that it's going to be really kind of hard for them to tank. But they do kind of have Wall with his knick-knack injuries and Beal, obviously. You do kind of have an excuse to set that down. Another thing actually is Alan Anderson actually played for the Wizards in this game, and he was okay. So maybe he's someone who can help them a little bit as well going forward.
Hopefully. We both really like him when he's healthy.
We also saw the end of the Knicks-Indiana game, something I wanted to talk about again because we talked about this on the last program, that with Miles Turner playing the four, especially down the end of games, we're going to see kind of this chess match between him playing as a traditional four and then teams trying to go small against them. The Knicks had a front court of Lance Thomas, Porzingis, and Carmelo. And so Turner actually got caught on Anthony a couple of times. He had to guard Thomas, who's been shooting threes pretty well this year so far. Jan Mahimi also had to guard Porzingis on the perimeter. And I thought ultimately Indiana looked just fine. And then Turner was able to get a couple of buckets on Lance Thomas, one on Carmelo. And it seemed like Indiana, as they won, kind of won that battle again.
They did, and one of the things that stuck out to me in this game was, so Matt Moore tweeted out towards the end of the game, I believe it was a 6-second, might have even been a 9-second differential, something in that range.
No, it wasn't even, yeah, it was less than that. It was like 29.2 seconds left when the Pacers got the ball up by one, I think.
Yeah, I think it was one. And so Matt tweeted out that he supports not fouling there, because, and part of the rationale is that teams always shoot early. And he's right. It does happen a lot. And Monte Ellis never fails to disappoint in that. He shot with 9 seconds left in the shot clock, not in the game clock, in the shot clock.
Yeah, but it was such a good look, fading away, sprinting to his right. From the right baseline, you know, you got to take that when you get a chance.
It's what you do when you have it all, man.
I think really, if you have a timeout, as the Knicks did, with a 3-second differential or more, you just play it out and play defense. Now, there is some risk that if the other team takes a three right as the shot clock's expiring and they hit the rim, you could be left with like 1 second left, assuming you get the defensive rebound. Or the other team would be very wise to crash the offensive boards really hard in that situation and either get the rebound or kind of muck up your rebound, just tip it around and mess things up. But I think 5 second, 4 second differential, you probably play D. Obviously, it worked out then for the Knicks. And then the play that they ran was a pick and pop with Galloway handling the ball. Porzingis actually popped to the top of the key. It was wide open for three. And Galloway, you see the difference between him and a guy who's a real traditional point guard. Galloway just couldn't get him the ball. You know, someone like Steph Curry could have just kind of flipped a behind-the-back pass to Porzingis, and he would have had a wide-open three. Galloway had to sort of like, you know, was double-teamed. All right, I got to pick up my dribble and sort of like, you know, pass fake and then lean over and bounce it to him. And by that point, Porzingis' defender was able to get back to him. Porzingis still took the shot. It was a decent look, but it could have been a great look if Galloway had shown a little bit more point guard skills.
Yeah, and then they actually ended up getting another chance after that, and Melo airballed the three as time expired.
Yeah, that was a nice play,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, absolutely. They got a look.
He was able to get as good of a look as you'd expect. There was only 1.9 remaining at that point, so that's not enough time left to foul if you're Indy, because you know that whoever catches it is going to go right up with the shot. And he eluded George well enough to get a good look, but it ended up being an air ball. One thing that Bob Bulgaris was really hitting on that I completely agree with is Rambis playing Porzingis and Melo, granted two of their three best players, Lopez being the other one who's actually any good, playing those guys just a ton of minutes, because his incentive is for them to play well and to get the job permanently, as Phil Jackson sort of seems predisposed to these triangle guys. He probably actually has a decent shot at it, but if he's going to play these guys a ton of minutes with them totally out of the playoffs, that is not what he should be doing.
So he played a little less. Melo played a little less than 35 minutes tonight. That was significantly the least he's played in their last three games. They've had alternating, so they haven't had back-to-backs, but he played over 37 minutes in their game before that, and he played 41 against Minnesota.
And he's missed a ton of time this year with this left knee, where he's already had that debridement last year, a very serious surgery. It's something that's kind of really just a wear and tear issue. It's a very clear relationship between playing a lot of minutes and that sort of thing. And then Porzingis, as a guy, you know, our buddy Jared Dubin just had a piece on, all right, how are they going to keep this guy healthy at 7'3"? And really, I think with this turning into kind of a lost season, yeah, you don't have your draft pick, but how about you just limit those guys both to like 32 minutes a game? Because you need Carmelo to age well and still be good next year when you might actually be able to make something yourselves. And, you know, they've got Derek Williams who didn't play at all. They kind of really want him to opt out next year, and he's not going to opt out if you don't play him at all, so that it looks like he's not worth signing. So Aaron Aflalo, they kind of just dumped him on the bench after the third quarter, which I don't think he's that great. It's not the end of the world, but he's another guy who they're going to kind of hope is going to opt out if they're going to use their cap space. So a lot of sort of perverse incentives here for the Knicks, especially because they don't have their draft pick. But I think a lot of those incentives may be pushing them in a bad long-term direction. We'll have to keep track of this more as the rest of the year continues.
I have to say that I am absolutely enthralled by devious GM/coach Nate Duncan.
All right, that'll do it for today. You wrote a good piece that I will plug for you, which is the San Antonio Spurs off-season preview. You're starting to do a series of that now, and that'll make up worth reading, certainly, but that can make a nice basis for when we get into our team off-season previews, you know, in May and June as the playoffs start to go on to more of sort of a one-game-per-night basis. So, yeah, who's next for that series for you?
I don't know which one they're going to run next. I actually have, I think, the next 10 written. So we'll see where they go. It's the idea is that they're going to run for the next couple months. I'm going to do every single team, as Nate said, and we're going broadly from top to bottom, which I think is a really cool idea. That was my editor, Adi Joseph's idea. And so the idea is that for the teams that are a little bit worse later on, that's going to be what we're talking about. But for teams like the Spurs, it can be a resource that we can go back to later. So you're going to be seeing good teams soon. I would guess it'll be the Warriors in the next couple of days. But I think it's going to be 2 a week, maybe 3 weeks sometime for the next 2-3 months. And then I also did an AMA on Reddit yesterday on NBA Reddit, which was really fun. I answered questions for about 3.5 hours, and I personally love doing those. I kind of get zoned in on it, but it's a lot of fun to do. And yeah, so that, and then we'll see where the content goes in terms of the off-season previews. But thinking about where all these teams are going to be has made me even more juiced for this offseason, because it's going to be absolutely insane.
Yeah, and the Spurs, they really kind of need Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili to come back.
They don't have much flexibility.
And they also, if those guys opt out, they both have player options. They basically may be able to take advantage of a little loophole that I sort of was thinking about last year, that since they'll still have bird rights on those guys, they're able to pay them very little, fit LaMarcus under the cap, and then maybe they make it up to him next year with a huge salary. That might be something we might see. We might see something like that with Wade, where they give him a real low contract this next year, and then they make it up to him again in 2017-18. Just another little kind of cap loophole that we might see. So I think the Spurs offseason could be a little bit more interesting than maybe we're expecting, even though they'll probably be kind of capped out. For me, just follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I'm usually live tweeting the games. And you can follow Danny on Twitter at Danny LaRue. And if you're in the Bay Area, come check out that Stanford GSB sports conference on March 2nd. That'll be pretty fun. I'll be doing that panel. So we'll talk to you all next time.